Hi. Hey, thanks for coming out tonight. On behalf of myself and Joan, thank you for choosing us over Barbie and Oppenheimer for this evening's entertainment. And of course, always thanks to Ari for everything, and to White Whale for hosting us and giving us a home. We always, always really appreciate that. To make it feel more like Hemingway's, if you order a beer, please steal some on the floor. Ownership has told me time and again, I really appreciate that. So try to do that, okay? So tonight I wanted to read a poem by Christopher Gilbert, but I really wasn't sure what to choose. There were so many good ones. But earlier today I was listening to a new archival release of John Coltrane and Eric Dolphy of The Village Gate in 1961. And that kind of made the decision for me. Here we go. I've had a week off, so I'm going to see it anyways. This is called Metaphor for Something That Plays Us. Remembering Eric Dolphy. Memory, you made up map of presences, odd attention mending itself into record, which becomes a world worked out inside us. You make my nature a dressed up feeling, which grows on the given today and on the hunger of the horizon ahead, which we fill more or less with an act. Act which is not shallow, but flute breaths fluttering down, all blue notes, and the 80s longing where I walk through a park of Dutch diseased elms. The early death a generation ago of Eric Dolphy on my mind. When a young bird's plaintive cry, an evanescent burst from the chest, asks that I hear it singing. My eventual breath is seed, while what's going on in the trees becomes a belief that rustling of the leaves is an expression of form. Everything becoming backdrop. Even the traffic at the corner up ahead in the future where the park ends mimics a chorus humming at full stop. Listen, hear how the meaning of each moment is the dialect gained when the future assumes the flesh. I traipse through trash thickets where the acting president's civil wrongs have trickled down, humming what bits I can out to lunch. By the time I get to a bench at the park's edge where the traffic strict metronomic thickens to bicker against the music in my head, I feel sick, my root afflicted with the day's euphoric waste that I must fight else it fills me to the quick. But listen. Even the righteous tire of trying to get it right. The way we'd like to be like the pure interest, like that wild witness who uses the caustic specks of this false nature, but is not a victim of the mess. Old, absorbed bystander. We made Dolphy into them. And where did it leave him? So out of this world, a bothered god in his music, against the lavish nothing mass-produced by the orchestra of indifference. That was not his what is here. A striving thing, standing beside himself in light of the times. Blood, breath, beautiful momentary being, a demo of the striving. Undoing the definition of the diatonic scale, or displaying his life as a voice, his only future was to invent a language where he became his own name, pouring from the mouth of his horn. So much the music of this human world, he never had an audience, never found another who could talk back. Man, we mess it all up. We step forward into our urban selves, all faithless, and he, as though a presence, is a paint job, a fashion, that put on face which has its moment that then, like an uncoded character left in the oblivious weather, simply fades away. feathers will be falling off Dolphy's face forever. So there is something being said. Here is a songbird's call, a flute's bent plea, notes into wail, gathers the pour from the mouth of the teenager who I will say has come to the park to be alone, because it all feels wrong at home. I walk closer to the traffic's noise and see my face in the driver's seat and the Chevy streaking away from me. And in this instant, it seems that none of this, the bird's cry, the flute's plea, the runaway, Dolphy, this passing moment, or I, amounts to more than a picture, splintering here into dust and time, where each blue feeling is like a word sound when it is read to no one. Yet, when I remember Dolphy, I am aware of myself humming a set of notes whose sequence tells a story that I become a vowel. Just as, out of attention, when you say these words, I am brought to mind. The practice of the tenderness, you have become a witness for. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you to our readers. Romain, as always, it is my distinct honor to bring you Joe Bauer.
Wow. What a poem. Thank you for all being here tonight. And there are some, it's wonderful to see some of you returning and a lot of new faces. Now, this reading series has gone on for apparently 49 years. Most of it in the back bar, the back of our Hemingway's cafe, and now we're really thrilled to be here so that we are among all these books, and also we can have the series available to all the folks in Zoom land. So hi, folks in Zoom land. Thanks for being here. And White Whale's been a great host. I want to mention, although Ari mentioned already, that 2 weeks from now, we'll be having the last reading in this series. And our poets will be Miss McCloss, also known as Sheena Carroll, Laura Jaquila, Dave Newman, Cedric Rudolph, and Kayla Sargeson. I hope you will come back for that. I think it'll be wonderful. But tonight is going to be amazing. So let's get started. Our first poet reading is Sarah Williams Devereaux, author of A Mother, a chapbook coming out later this year from Finishing Line Press. Her poetry has appeared in journals, Friction Log, Snapdragon, anthologies, Show Us Your Papers, yes, radio, and also at the Westmoreland Museum of American Art. She teaches poetry for the Mad Women in the Attic workshops of Carlo University. She is an apprentice training instructor for Amherst's Writers and Artists Writing Group. And she earned her MA in teaching writing from Johns Hopkins University. And we're so looking forward to seeing this chapbook. Ooh, please welcome Sarah Williams Devereaux.
Need to get an automatic one like the that they have at the Oscars and stuff. Great program will raise and lower. Yeah. So thank you everyone for being here. Thank you to Joan and Chris for the invitation. Thank you to all the folks at White Whale for existing. Joan had mentioned that I have a poetry chapbook that is coming out, and that is from Finishing Line Press. It's called Of a Mother. And I am extremely proud of it and extremely excited to have it coming out. For those of you who are here in the room, I do have postcards along with all of the other books that are there that has ordering information. So feel free to grab one of those. And for anyone who is on the Zoom, it is at finishinglinepress.com. So the first three pieces I'm going to read are from Of a Mother. And this was a collection that came about looking at the passing of my mother from leiomyosarcoma. Can everyone hear me in the back? Okay, good. Terminal lucidity. The school kids down the street from my house draw robots, hopscotch, flowers, dragons on the pavement. When the rain comes, there's a moment when the lines of dust bloom, come alive. Color pops against the soaked stone, turning cheap chalk into spring, summer, saturated, glowing, before they're washed away. It's called terminal lucidity, a period of lightness and health before the person starts to die for real. On that Monday, you talked all day, drank the chocolate milk I made, washed your afternoon soaps, laughed with the nurse who sponge bathed you, rubbed orange vanilla lotion into your skin. You slept soundly all afternoon until the color of your urine turned to brown. You were all sky blue and yellow then, your star tattoo, your cotton sheets, a touch of white, the last bits of hair on your head, and gold somewhere in your shrunken body and tired heart. Equilibrium. Your hand is the only warm thing about you. 3 hours later, lying in mine, as I sit by your bedside and watch you start to die even more. You stopped breathing long ago, your lungs quiet to the naked eye, but your body is still moving in the places I can't see. Your blood moves down your body, pooled by gravity, leaves purpling bruises on your legs, the undersides of your arms. Your eyes are closed. We have no cotton strip for your jaw, so it hangs open a little, the way it did when we slept, breathing through your mouth in the night. I am fascinated by it, for I start to see you as not yourself, but as your body. How a body can change even when dead. How movement can occur separate from life, guided by forces bigger than the sorrow we shared. Heat moving out from your skin, heat moving in from my hand to yours, keeping pink against the sallow yellow of the rest of you, keeping it soft against the new gradual stiffening, keeping it able to hold me a little longer. And this last piece is called The Slide of Water. Some from the book, not the lesson we read today. The Slide of Water. Sometimes I wish you had been buried. You died in fire, complaining to the last that the hospice room was too hot. You were cremated, all the moisture torn from your brittle bones you relied on. You never felt this slide of water across your bones, your dead skin, felt the cool embrace of earth, a touch of rainwater on your brow, a cold compress on feverish flesh, a bed of moss and earth and roots to hold you as you sagged, the support you had wished for all your life, yet pushed away, too proud, too afraid to ask for a soft, nourished, watered place where you could truly fall apart down to your bones, where no one would berate you, no one would shame you, only gently lay you down until you were still. So again, those are three pieces from Of a Mother, from Finishing Line Press, and that is going to be coming out at the end of September. You could buy a copy now. Next few pieces are some new things that I'm working on about chronic illness and body work. And this is the title of the poem, Body Work. When we first started, you could barely touch me. Fingers barely slipping over skin. My flesh as hard as an unripe pear, but filled with the pain of blackened bananas, prickly pears, pineapple leaves. I don't even remember all of that first massage, just your hand on my back in the darkness, my face on the head pillow, and the radiance of soreness through me, so full of heat you could have warmed yourself at it. There is a limit as to how much healing the body can take at one time, eventually pulsing down to a pulp, to a terrible brown, soft spot, mealy and mushy and so, so terrible. You could barely touch me then. I could barely touch myself. Why would I, as I rotted from the inside out? But you knew better. You knew that I wasn't fruit, but living meat that could grow more tender with the pushing and pulling. You knew where all my fibrous strings were knotted up, tensed in animal fear, knew that where the pain was felt was not where the pain truly came from, knew that the pain came from staying still too long or stretching myself too hard, reaching for something I knew was out of my grasp. He worked on one spot here, one there, letting each space rest before coming back to it, more tender than before, but more pliable, like stiff leather, worked and oiled and smoothed until it could bend and flex, easily shaped into a new skin to live in. So this is what happens, I bring too many poems. I'll do these two. So this one is a golden shovel, and that is a form that Terrence Hayes came up with using the works of Gwendolyn Brooks. So this is a golden shovel after Gwendolyn Brooks's My Dreams, My Works Must Wait Till After Hell. What light comes? I don't want to unknow anymore. I don't want to search my heart for half-assed solutions, dig for my dreams like a rifling through a junk drawer. When will my soul decide what grand works it wants to build, what coliseums or pyramids? I must not succumb to ordinary waiting, sitting at the bus stop for a ride that will never come. I must till my own soil now, slip seeds into sweet earth, learn what light comes after leaving the darkness of hell. And I'll read one more. And again, thank you to everyone involved in this reading series, in this place, in the world of poetry. Buddha. It was the smile that did it for me, upturned at the edges, as if marked a little harder by the playmaker, lips wide and full, as befitting a man from India. The smile that got me to buy the sculpture from Casablanca, the hippie global store in Squirrel Hill, Asian folks and Jewish folks passing outside while I stood in the very back, surrounded by glass lanterns, swirling tapestries, Palo Santo, looking for something for my altar, my gahangzin in the plastic butsudan I got from the Buddhist center, sitting on my cheap bookshelf, flanked by only a few candles, a tiny bell, atop a copy of a liturgy I'd chanted over and over that one terrible summer in my house, on the bus, at work, everywhere I could to keep myself from going crazy, the pressures of my life building faster than I could chant, finally collapsing for 11 days in the psych ward, the words of Buddha and the words of therapy carrying me forward, walking into a healthier way, walking into the store where I held the sculpture in my hands, turning it over and over, peering at the detail of the carving, his friendly lips, his kinky curls, his long, flexible fingers, his halo of paisley flowers, his eyes still closed, smiling all the while, as if to say, take me home, and someday, when the time is right, I will open my eyes, and you will be ready. Thank you, everybody. I think that was one sentence. Thank you again.
Wonderful reading, sir. You did. And I would just remind us all, we've got to, for the people in Zoom land to be able to actually hear us, we have to actually speak in the mic. You did a great job. The other way. Okay. I'm trying to remember. Christine Stroud is the editor-in-chief of Autumn House Press. Her chapbook, The Buried Return, was released by Finishing Line Press in March of 2014. And her second chapbook, Sister Sweet, came out in 2017 from Disorder Press. I love that, Disorder Press. Strouds of poems have appeared in Prairie Schooner, Hobart, The Ninth Letter Online, The Patterson Literary Review, Simran Review, and others, and many others. Please welcome Christine Stroud.
Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Chris. It is a real honor to be reading at Hemingway's for the first time ever, even though we are at White Whale as Hemingway's. Still exciting. It's cooler here and it smells better. So thank you both. 49 years is a huge accomplishment as a writer and also as a publisher and somebody who has planned events. I'm in awe of you all and what you have done for this community. And so thank you for everything. Also, of course, thank you to White Whale and to Ari for her great introduction. And thank you to Sarah. It's going to be really fun after you. Your poems are incredible. So I'm going to be reading from my book in progress, currently called The Island. Brings a lot of images from the area where I grew up, which was Eastern North Carolina, right on the coast. So lots of water, lots of nature. Beautiful, but also very scary because of hurricanes and alligators and things like that. Okay. An elegy and admission. If only he'd gone on being lost, riding the high line, camped out in a cold yard. I could have talked to his father about the burnt out engines on the lawn, bones tucked in the branches, stuck in the shrubs. I could have told him, your son had been good. Washing his friends' feet with oil, washing their feet with his hair. If there was goodness, he gave it. If there was grace, it was ours. But I would have left out how he once threw his words into the ocean, began tucking seashells into his mouth. Still, every morning he tried to speak, tried to explain, and I listened, even if I didn't always understand. Was it to be colorblind after having once known color? To understand the rhythm of the tide only to watch it reverse its dependable motion? I was trying not to notice the water glass on the table's edge, the unanswered alarm. I sat on the couch all day with questions hanging like smoke above my head. When I called out down the hallway, he didn't answer, and I never got up to check. So this next one I'm reading, I've been really pushing myself to write a long poem. I usually write one page and then I'm done. So it's something I'm trying to work against. So congratulate me, I wrote a 5-page poem. But wait, before you run to the door, each page is only this one. Don't freak out. The boys at the end of the street. They hid their bodies behind the tree line, behind the thin pines, running out into the road to catch us, making no noise, not saying a word, just the beating echoes of footfall, footfall, footfall. They left dirt packed under their fingernails, sucked at the salty grit when their minds wandered. No one ever asked what they might be thinking. 2. They hid their parents' wedding photos and would never say where. They couldn't remember, they said. They said nothing. They shrugged. They looked back at their parents for a long time and didn't blink. They told us not to come by if their dad had been drinking, his face a dewy pink, voice high-pitched, music from the kitchen radio loud, his whole face a smile. He seems much kinder when he's drunk, we protested. But no, they said, don't. 3. They wore shirts with stretched out collars and began visiting neighbors' garages when no one was home. The door always unlocked, the spaces all smelling the same. Stale marsh air and gasoline, but each held something new to be found. A hunting knife, a jar filled with marbles, magazines with women with no clothes on, an oily, unused bike chain, a small wooden frog that they gave us and we loved and then we lost. They touched every surface, held every object up to the weak light coming through the back door. In their hands, it was new, and that light, it was theirs. 4. They began visiting the houses too, but told no one, not even us. They took their shoes off by the door and moved through the rooms without making a noise, without saying a word. Some women mentioned to their husbands that some of their intimates seemed to be missing, and an older girl home from college asked her mom where some of her laundry might be. They hid the panties in the forest, buried them, so when it rained, the white cotton and pink lace became soiled and stained. But still, they went back again and again. 5. We didn't see them at the river anymore with their bait and tackle, only glimpsed them briefly from our windows as their bikes glided by. We thought to visit, but didn't. Always turning back before reaching where the road ended, where it suddenly became trees, where their house was, so close, and then not. They sat on their front porch long after the neighborhood went to sleep. They grew and they grew until they were men. I don't know when my father quit the house. When the walks out became longer. He mentioned the deer, but never the wolf. No warning about how quickly the light wanes, how damp the forest would grow. I would visit him in the beginning as the mushrooms began to sprout like ears all over his body. Watch as he slunk farther and farther down into that dark shade. Do we sleep in shifts? Do we wake before dawn? Each time I said, you should come back, he heard instead, you can't come back. I've spent years biting my fingernails as the wolves brushed up against my legs. Do we never hear the same words? Do we still believe in the deer? The lichen began to grow in patches over his face. He became an instrument. Unstrung and forgotten. Do we trust in the dark?
Do we love the wolves too? This will be my last one. Thank you all again. The artist. We're all seeking the truth, I suppose. He spends hours mixing and remixing paints. No canvas, no single story is safe from revision of being over or unwritten or told again and then again and then again. We're all trying to be understood, I suppose, but all interpretation becomes demeaning. When the morning sunlight comes through the bedroom window, it ruins everything and it translates nothing. We're all trying to find our other, if there is such a thing, but every time he tries to imagine, it's just a black canvas with that single wound of blue. It doesn't mean anything, or it does, or it doesn't to the others. He mixes again, he paints again, he's trying. I know. Thank you.
All right. Now, Daniela Buccelli and I go way back. We were in a Madwoman manuscript classes, I think 15 years ago. I think two of them. And so it is so wonderful to have her reading for Hemingway series again. And I'm really looking forward to this new book she's working on. Daniela Buccelli's poetry can be found in Patterson Literary Review, Northern Appalachian Review, Cimarron Review, Voices in the Attic. Her chapbook, What It Takes to Carry, came out a while back, and she co-edited Show Us Your Papers, a poetry anthology. She teaches, yes, in a local high school and has earned her MFA in poetry from Carlo and one in fiction from the University of Pittsburgh. She serves as her as secretary of her uni.
Yeah, baby.
Yes. Yes. Please welcome Daniela Buccelli.
I really appreciate that. Yeah. I was just talking to the union president before I showed up. We're always texting. Dan, if you're listening, this is why I couldn't keep talking. So here we go. So I have a chapbook over there on the counter with the others. I'm not going to read anything from it. but it's really good.
Yes,
it is. Yes. Oh, yes. Elizabeth and Christine, thank you. I want to say that just a couple days ago, I was in a different city and I went to an open mic. And I didn't know anybody in there, and yet I did. It was like, oh, my family. I was all dressed up. People were dressed down. People wore cosplay. People were all over the place there. And we were all kind of a family. I recognized myself, as I do now, with the youngs and the not so youngs. As I get older, it's more and more important to recognize your family. All right, so my manuscript is called Forestiera. I speak a little Italian. It's born in a different country. And the first poem here is probably the first poem that in that manuscript. It's called Friends, Rome, and Country. Where in Italy were you born? The hillbilly part of the boot. North or south? If you like World War II history, it's the Gustav line. I don't know my history, but we do love Italy. The monastery at Cassina. I don't know my geography. Florence, Rome, or Sicily? the small town near Rome. There are small towns near Rome. Someone I know is from Abruzzi. Is it in Abruzzi? Before the war, Abruzzo. After the war, Lazio. Do you ever go back? When I want to, if I can, in my sleep, sometimes the world reminds me. Italy's a dreamy place. Yes, where everyone's you and you can't figure out what's happened or why. Do you have family back there, both sides, dead and alive, friends, enemies, and strangers? The manuscript, I was obsessed with a story my mother told me about her town. I did a lot of research. So this poem is about my mom. And then the second poem was, I think, yeah, about like the research I did. This poem is called We Messy You. It really is it's a poem of answers. So I know you're all poets out there too. So it's a list poem about answers. And well, what the question is, could be many questions, but that's what you can figure out. I know my question. We messy you because I love her. Her body is the one that held me near unbearable. Because I look for her in every woman, man, child, ask them what I am worth. Because I have her mouth. Once she asked, she said she needed me to write in English to the priest about his politics, because she had nightmares of sitting for an exam, having learned the wrong material, because she drew elaborate tracery on nailers, a medieval monk. She was an artist, because she wrote, "We messy you" on a birthday card, though she meant, "We miss you." Because she whipped vanilla and chocolate cream for the rum cakes she took to parties. Because she believed children should not wear black. Non fai la scema. Secrets are for keeping. Because in 1975, in an interior decorating course, she had proof that she could have been what she wanted to be. Because alone, nearly 21, on an airplane among strangers she couldn't speak with, she left her mother. Because she didn't know what to do with the infant on her lap in the messy linen diaper stinking up the cabin, because she was embarrassed at how offensive we both were. So I was obsessed over a historical story about 28 people interned in my mother's village. The village is a very complicated place for me, like a lot of immigrants. Every time we had money, we tried to go back. And it was like almost every other year, but sometimes every third year. And so my book is called Forestiera, which is an Italian word for the foreign woman. Unlike poetry readings, I kind of feel foreign everywhere I go. Anyway, so I did some research. This is called The World Invades. The two local historians have researched the details about the internment of 28 people in my mother's town during the Second World War. One historian lives in the town, the other lives in my father's town next door. One historian presents as male,
the other as female. One a respected medievalist, the other a 20th century scholar. They have gathered photographs and interviews of eyewitnesses and survivors for me. One knows my mother, the other my father. They agree to meet me, the daughter of their classmate, since I am a poet with questions about history, since all three of us have been school teachers. They know each other's books, have not attended each other's lectures, do not recommend each other's conclusions. They ask me about my parents. They ask about my studies. The world invades Italy every August. It is August. I am in his office. I meet his wife, the children's author. The other comes to my mother's apartment. I meet her daughter and granddaughter. One of them identifies as a victim of refugees. The other has as the ally of the colonized. One wants a copy of my findings. The other brought Ameretti. They live in deserted towns. Neither answers my questions about the victims, about the villains, or the villagers.
So, my brother, one of my best friends, my brother is one of my best friends, and he and I went to Italy every once in a while. He hated it. I liked it sometimes. This is called Allegiances, about a memory. And Allegiances. Foreigners urgent in the Italian bar one afternoon, my brother shoving a pinball machine against a wall. I was missing America's guttural R, the roll, growl, and mumble of making myself understood. We had arrived in a Fiat full of relatives. My head through the roof, the car swung. I fell on a cousin's lap who sat in the lap of an aunt. Just another summer in Italy, but we couldn't tell for sure what was normal and what was not. Were we on vacation or kidnapped by our mother? Our father cries on the phone. Ferragosto's over. We're missing the start of school. Allegiances shift to this valley town, the most beautiful in the world, my mother said. Also dreadful, and I feel lost. The pinball champ spasmodic between my brother's forearms, women in bikinis suspended in the lit jukebox, resplendent until the bar owner yanks the plug. Vattene. The dings, the winding sacks, the flippers smacking hollow. Stop. Vattene means get out. We would like, I'm sure you've been to, some of you have been to Europe. If you go to Italy, they close the stores in a day. But we were American. We were like, we just woke up. I think I'm going to end with maybe something. Okay, this is a found poem. So my teacher and me wants to say, go and look for the found poems all around us. This is an article, this really happened. And we didn't go see Barbie tonight, but maybe this will satisfy. This one is called The Girl Who Saves the World. At the lake level shallow, we had to warn the boats. Daddy begged me rush with the boys, but I like to take my time about things. I crawled on my arms and knees in the clay and sand along the bottom, cool. Not, no hotter summer, these 260 years different from the sticks and rocks I usually find. I pulled it out of smooth mud, one end a point, the other a handle, my hand on my hip. I aimed it at the sky. I ran to my mama and my mormor, sitting having fika. I found a sword. The archaeologist had goosebumps from before the Vikings. The diggers looked for more and found a brooch as old as my sword. I did tell Emmy, who now I know to trust, she told no one. I am Saga Benesek, queen of the brave. Thanks, guys.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. And our final reader of this week, week seven, Cameron Barnett, a Pittsburgh poet, teacher, and emerging Black writer in residence at Chatham University. He is the author of The Drowning Boy's Guide to Water, and Murmur, forthcoming from Autumn House Press. His work explores the complexity of relationships, race, and place for Black people in America, more of which can be found at his website, CameronBarnett.net. Please welcome Cameron Barnett.
Everyone for coming out or staying home, those of you at Zoom, I should say. Thank you, Joe, thank you, Chris, everyone. Beautiful work. And to White Whale and to Ari, wherever they're at, thank you very much. I'm going to read all poems from the forthcoming book, from Murmur, a couple of which have some notes. So I'll note those as I go. This first one, it's called South Carolina. And the one thing that you need to know, I think, for this poem, because I didn't know this when I went there, is they have these things called joggling boards. Has anyone ever heard of a joggling board? Okay. A joggling board is like this really weird long bench that when you sit on it and like bounce on it, and it like brings two people together as they like sit on it and bounce. There's something about like lovers like sitting on this to like figure out if you're actually like gonna make it, keep that bounce together. Weird. Yes, I did test it out. Anyway, so there's a reference to that in this poem. South Carolina, March 2020. The land is an open mouth full of water. Even the rain has nowhere to go. It sits and seeps by the road on the way to the plantation I visit one night. Under a Chinese light show, I hold my love's white hand while we pass LED frogs and dragons. I'm not looking at the lights. I regard the live oaks and what they might know. Perhaps we recognize each other. I didn't know how wooded this land was. I don't know everything that these woods know, but I know the dark edges of the plantation hold back everything I love. The pulse in my neck is a whisper of wings through the branches. In the air, a barracoon tune hangs like Spanish moss. In this, my making. In this, my heart. There is no joggling board flexible enough to bring together my tears and the turf. From here, perhaps I come through a line of blacksmiths. The sense is called illiterate. And from illiteracy, they come with the name fogey hammered into their blood. And from some other blood, we know they were purchased. I regard South Carolina as I do Ireland, two islands in the sea of my becoming. Sometimes I wonder what else the land has lied to me about. I wonder what the history books would say if they knew how blood could echo. I wonder today, as the news plays, what they expect me to think of distance, as if this land hasn't been teaching it to me all along. This poem is called I Was Made Fingerprint First, and the title bleeds into the rest of the poem. I was made fingerprint first, so I would always know the price of touch. I was made with a parapet septum. When they passed a stud finder over it, mom's breath surfaced. I was made hot in the blood, and my God-knotted ghosts nodded their heads in quorum. I've been on fire ever since. My sister was made from the wink of a telescope. My sister was made from the wink of a lighthouse. My brother from a telescope clapping in on itself. It's easy to forget about your heart until you need it. I was made unable to forget. I was made from the dirt. Dad and I dig through the earth to find each other's voices. I've been working on being worthy, on building such a man. And when you found out, I gave it all my thought. And when you learned my scheme, disapproval escaped volcanic through your throat like the pop of a soda can. And when I said I'd start over, that's when you learned to love me. I was made then too, like the world itself, one tectonic tug at a time. This next poem is called Ghost Lessons. The thing to know about this is that there's several blackouts or redactions in this piece, so I'm just gonna snap whenever those come up. Ghost Lessons. My great-great-great-grandmother stares at me in sepia. We both stand in our own classrooms. History has a funny way of being a hallway, an isthmus, or sometimes a thimble covering with hopes to avoid piercing. How do you hold a family together? Pin this. Portia would flourish her hands in bidwifts to show off her friends, diamonds on different fingers. What hands can hold is often all that's passed on, often. My grandmothers pulled thread through Pittsburgh, master seamstresses, their hands stitching steel through cloth, white passing palms and pulses soft beneath skin, which can be a thimble itself if you let the pinpricks and teach you. I have learned teaching is a thing of the blood. Dad taught me when to tuck my tongue in my pocket, when to listen. When they speak, my elders drop A's from their day, so it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Ancestry is one giant game of telephone echoed through tin can decades. Pin this, Porky hiding happiness deep in his dimples. Pin this, Spoogey and Pigeon took the yellow boat out in LA and the sea nearly took them. A name is a story, and Dad taught me not to tell all my stories at once. Then we both forgot. I remind myself there's, in remembrance, a heaven all around me. A ghost of mine is colorblind when it looks out at the world. A ghost of mine is colorblind when it looks at itself. What right do I have to play the prism? My matriarchs pulled legacy through eyes of steel, and still so many people in my family have tried or failed or succeeded at leaving this land. Sometimes I almost believe I understand. Pin this. The Barnetts backstitched love into this land to make sure I'd always feel held, even when I knit negativity out of whole cloth or search for purpose in my pinpricks. My grandmother's new needles pull more than thread. I'm searching their patterns for all the lessons of ancestry left behind. How to mend your heart. How to be a better man. How to be Black. How Black to be. How to write the story of yourself. This next poem is called Breath, and this is a perfect encapsulation of how I can be a super nerdy writer sometimes, because this is written after an episode of the podcast Radiolab that's called Breath. And I don't know if anyone's heard this. You should go back and find this podcast. It's crazy, and I'm not going to do it justice, but basically all of us in this room when we were born had a hole in our heart on purpose, and it has to like snap close when you're born, and it's this whole process with the umbilical cord, and it's like how breathing works in mammals. It's crazy. Blew my mind. So I had to write this poem, and it's based off of that. The other thing you might need to know is I use the word allograph in here, and allograph is a word for a letter in an alphabet that stands in place of another letter. So that can be as simple as like a capital A standing for a lowercase a, but also the Romans, when they used V for U and V back in the day, it's called an allograph. Now you know. Breath. What I'm saying is blood was never blue, never neatly distinguished nor diagrammed. What I'm saying is that Newton's third law states every prayer has an equal and opposite verse. What I'm saying is that all our hearts once held trap doors that helped us slip past suffocation, but a trap door can only be a trap once. Hallelujah. You were your mother's blood, her body, and yes, her breath. You carry the scar of her love, or as Newton suggests, her pain too. The heart is the only organ we describe in chambers, a place of meeting rooms meant for not meeting. What I'm saying is there was a time we all broke the rules. They want you to forget your first breaths past their mom's lips. They want me to fall through trapdoors and disappear umbilically. Be it red or blue, your blood is an allograph of inhalation, a synonym, a murmur. What I'm saying is your last breath is the curse of your first, that all the letters of your alphabet belong to the wind and your mother's wishes, lies, and dreams slip between the chambers of your heart because, whether broken or whole, a promise is an allograph of betrayal. Newton said it himself. That's just science. And the math is clear that our infant hearts have a word problem, hair triggered and primed to slip out beneath us. And by us, I mean them, who told you me is we. And I only know that this heartbeat of mine is a simple, persistent knock on the door asking to be let in, let out, to be let in again. Okay, I'm going to close with two more poems. And I always have to say this because I feel bad. This poem is written after a poem that was brought to me in a workshop, and I'm imitating like the movement in this, and I have no idea where that poem went. I cannot find it to give that person credit. So whoever you are out there, thanks for writing the dope poem to help me write what I hope is also a dope poem. I cut a sprig from a rosemary plant, and two more sprigs bloomed. I cut one of the new sprigs, and out came a thumb a lot like mine. I cut the thumb, and out spilled blood. I cut the blood, and out came a flag. I cut the flag, and a firework emerged with a smoldering fuse. I cut the firework, and the Bill of Rights came spilling out. I cut the parchment, and there appeared my face. I cut my face, and out came the thumping of my teenage heart. I cut my heart, and out came my mother's murmur. I cut her murmur, and a blade sliced back at me. The blade cut my hand, and my own blood spilled into the rosemary pot. The blade cut the soil, and Aquarius sprang up and into the sky. The blade cut the water bearer, and a flood came down. The blade cut the flood, but the flood cut back, sharpening itself into the blade, and the water merged and became a needle. I picked up the needle, poked it through my palm, and heard my father cry for the first time. I sewed and sewed and sewed, but the thread kept cutting a hole in my hand wider and wider, and it sang as the thread passed through, and the song was a heartbeat, filling in the pauses between my own. I cut the thread, and the hole closed, and the crying stopped, and the water dried, and the only thing left was this song. It cut me open. It made a subwoofer out of my chest. Even now, when the doctor lays the stethoscope on me, she says, there are two hearts talking over each other. All right, last poem. Thank you again, everyone, for coming out, tuning in, posting, reading, everything. You're all wonderful. A second opinion. 1619, 1776, 1865. Because of these, I am. A rope rocks empty in the wind somewhere in Sumter because it never loved me. Maybe life is all fire and parlor walls. Still I go on, dreaming of writing a green book for the stars. Take me to Mars, tie my tongue in tectonics, then let me be redshifted into oblivion. This much I believe. The future doesn't have a price yet. A place is not who owns it. No book will make you love me. 1955, 1965, 1987. My heart is the space between boom bap, dap, and desperation. Sometimes I dream of a blacker me, and I know it is a dream because I can't see faces clearly in dreams, but I know a nesting doll, just like I know the panic of a dream ending from its rush and repetition. The night sky and the earth go on lying back and forth to each other, and from where I sit between them, I learn that stubbornness won't make me love me either. 1996, 2001, 2012. A road runs north from Langdon because it desperately wanted me to be. This much I know. A place is more than its truth. Some people have always known freedom. They aren't the only ones fit for it. Thank you.
Throughout the series this year, we've been closing the reading with a poem by Jimmy Savetic, who is the founder of this series. And he ran it on his own but for about 32 years. And he was, as many of you know, an undercover narcotics officer, a homicide detective, a security officer in Vietnam, the founder of a whole bunch of gyms in which he trained young people to box, young women and young men. And that goes on. Many of his poems were published on the last years of his life by Bob Ziller. And I'm going to read one that I was really surprised to see, because he writes a lot about being a police officer. He writes a lot about actually sitting in a bar with retirees and going over like what life was like and what their lives are like now, what were like then, and a lot of poems about his mother chasing him around the house with a strap. But here's one I just did not expect to see. Strange. George B. When I think of my father, I think of a huge bell and Notre Dame, but the huge bell has no clapping. Or instead of Notre Dame, I think of Trieste, or better, Vienna. Sometimes I think of the little boy in Fatima and how he knew about the horror that was to come to the world told by the blessed mother. The old man just knew things, and he gave up his ears to the hammers banging in the mill for over 50 years, the banging, banging. He came home one day burnt from the hot slag flash from the ingot. The melting white steel went down his collar, down his back, burning the flesh off his ass and his leg, and landed in his boot, burning steel to the scream and scorched muscle to the bone. He laid on the couch for days and prayed the rosary, his strong fingers wearing the beads. And he said nothing of pain, no moan uttered from his lips. Then one day he got up and limped to the kitchen and made a bologna sandwich on dark bread, drank a cup of black coffee, and limped out the door to whistle off to work. I was both happy and sad to see the old man up. And my mother said, it's harder to live with a saint than a sinner. And the old man went to church every day, and he prayed and prayed, but he never told me why. And on a cold December day, he just laid on the kitchen floor. And his last words were, "Call me a priest." Sometimes I can hear the bells of Vienna, and I hunger for dark bread and bologna. So I want to go. Thank you all. Thanks for being here. Thanks to Rywell. Thanks to Chris. Whoa, didn't do this yet. I'll tell you. I want to give a shout out to Scott Silsby, Jason Baldiger, and Don Wentworth, who are co-hosting the Odd Month Poetry Series, which will feature this coming Saturday at Bantha Tea Bar, 7 o'clock. Chandra Alderman, who read here a few weeks ago, and two other poets whom I'm sure are wonderful, but I really recommend this. Okay. On Penn Avenue. And we are going to close this evening with a big thank you to White Whale. And just to let you know, we're going to do the photo. Okay. And so we're going to ask that as much as you all want to rush up here and tell them how amazing they all were, we would like to do the photo first. Okay. So the photo along with the audio for this reading will be on our blog soon. Thanks to Mr. Sturica there with the salmon colored hat. And that's Hemingway's poetryseries.blogspot.com. Finally, there are a lot of you I don't know here tonight. I am thrilled to see you all. I do something called the Pittsburgh Poetry Blast. If perhaps you would like to know about other events around the city that you might not know about otherwise, if you give me your name and email, I will put you on the list. And no salesman will call. So you can find me, I'll be around here. Now we are in a bookstore. You might've noticed that. We're in a bookstore. So, and we have some wonderful books for sale, and we wanna, you know, get a card from Sarah, because we look really looking for that, forward to that book coming out, and to Cameron's and to Daniela's and to Christine's. Yeah, coming soon. So thank you all, and just let us do the photo. Okay, and I think is the coffee still open or not?
Yeah, right after the show, come up, get a drink, and then I'll close.
Okay, and we promised we wouldn't be here until 10 at night. We promised that we would clear out of here at a decent hour so these people would go home. So get your books, get your coffee, and thank you all.